and welcome to All Brother, a podcast about Manchester/Salford's legendary musical institution, The Fall. Each week, you invite along a guest to chat about their memories and interactions with the group. You can find us on Spotify and Apple and all the usual suspects, but we're hosted at shows.acast.com/all-brother. For episode 3 of series 4, we've got some bad news and some good news. Unfortunately, given the limited window we had to speak with our guest, Steve was unable to join us. But given who it is, I'm sure you'll understand why we couldn't risk not getting him on. So it's with enormous gratitude and pride we're welcoming the one and only legend that is Dr. John Cooper Clarke, all the way from downtown LA before he recently took the stage at the Moroccan Lounge. Don't get much cooler than that, does it? If you enjoy our chat quite as much as I did, you're in for a real treat. So how you doing, John? You well?
Yeah, I'm all right. Kid, you?
Great, thank you. Yes, I believe the tour's going well.
Yeah, it's going good, yeah.
LA tonight?
Yeah, Los Angeles this evening, yeah.
The Moroccan Lounge, I believe.
The Morocco Lounge, yeah.
Yeah, is it particularly Moroccan, or is it...
I ain't seen the joint yet, but, you know, I suppose you can get a tagine in there, maybe.
You've got to wear a fez to get through the door.
Who knows? It's free and easy.
It'd be like Rick's Place.
Pardon?
It'd be like Rick's Place, that kind of a dive.
It's a Rick's Club Americane.
That'd be the place to play, that.
Yeah.
So I was watching you introducing the Arctic Monkeys the other night.
Oh, yeah.
That was quite amazing.
Out in Queens, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a good night.
I've never seen anybody try to sing along with a poem before.
That was good, wasn't it? Although
it was fantastic.
Fabulous, yeah.
Because I was going to ask about I Want to Be Yours, because I remember reading an interview with Alex Turner, and he said... when he did the song, he wanted it to be one of your poems set to music that didn't sound like The Fall.
Oh, that's a, because I mean, yeah, you'd have to kind of sing most of them, wouldn't you?
Yes, you would, yeah.
But he converted it into a song very well without doing very much, and that's the art of it, you know.
That is the art, yeah. Because what do you think the difference is then between a poem and a lyric?
That's a very intelligent question. There's a big difference. You've got to, you know, when you've got music involved, then you can kind of, music is a kind of shorthand for all kinds of emotions, right? But you've got to write it into a poem. You've got to not leave anything up to anybody's imagination. You know, you just got to write the music into the language, if you see what I mean. So there's a big...
I do see what you mean.
Big difference between writing songs and writing poetry. If I could write songs, I would have wrote songs. Many more people like songs than like poetry. You know, poetry is always seen as a kind of a bit of a minority sort of interest, right? You know, who likes poetry?
Yeah.
Nobody. I mean, that was the
one. Yeah, I mean.
When I started to do this for a living, you know, I didn't get no encouragement off anybody that they would say things like that. What do you want to do that for? Who likes poetry? Everybody. That's one of the reasons people are glad to leave school so they don't have to do more, you know. So I was very pleased when my poetry was introduced onto the educational syllabus back then.
It's incredible, yeah. I mean, that must be...
If it hadn't been for that, then Alex Turner might never have heard of my stuff.
Give over. You're not telling me Alex Turner heard your stuff at school. He must have some grounding.
Oh, no, yes, they did, yeah. That's where the boys heard my stuff. It was compulsory.
That's amazing.
It was compulsory. It was on the GCSE syllabus for a while. And
so it should be.
Not that particular one, but that, you know, whatever the one that was, I suppose it was Beasley Street, actually. That's the big earner for me, isn't it? The one that's the magnum opus. And I think that's one of the ones that they had to learn off by heart, Michael Gove style.
Yeah, I've heard you talking about that before. You're quite in favour of that, aren't you, rote learning for poetry?
That's what got me started in the poetry business, yeah, learning them off by heart. And it wasn't just a four-line jingle, neither. It was things like The Lady of Shalott by Alfred Lord Tennyson, and, you know, 25 pages of rhyming medievalist Victorian poetry there, you know, so... You know, I was.
It's a fine line, though, isn't it? I mean, for every one of person like you who got it and then went on to live with it, there must have been a lot of people who were put off by it.
Well, I was a weird kid like that. You know, I was. You know, I always used to be curious about the language used in hymns.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I used to think, you know, what could that be? What could, you know what I mean? And then I realized, you know, that meaning is not the most important thing when it comes to poetry.
I realized that fairly late there, because I can't remember who I was talking to, and we were talking about lyrics.
Who's this?
And he said, that's the big thing people get hung up on, is meaning.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, sometimes you just got to loosen up.
Yeah.
And let your imagination fly.
Indeed.
But it helps to have a big vocabulary.
Speaking of vocabulary, what I was going to ask you about is when you were saying about who makes money as a poet, yeah. You mentioned Pam Ayres.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm sure she must be making a good copeck. You know, she's a household name. You said poets, most people of a particular age in England anyway, they would come up with Pam Ayres as an example of a successful popular poet.
Because I was going to say, the thing that I think you've got in common with Pam Ayres, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, is you've both got the perfect voice for reading your own poetry.
Yeah, we kind of have. Yeah, she's got her her gentle country brogue there from where she come from, Oxfordshire, is it?
Somewhere like that, yeah. But you can, when you read one of her poems, you can only imagine her reading it out.
You can. Yeah. Yeah, but I don't get too hung up on accents and things like that. I'm a great believer in RP. The more people that understand what you're on about, the better. So I don't care. You know, I kind of take it bad when people say, it's a compliment, but I kind of take it bad when people say, you know, that my accent's got anything to do with the content of my poetry. I kind of get a bit snoopy about it, then, you know.
Oh, right, okay. That's taking a turn.
My accent is an accident, you know, but I work at my poetry, you know. So obviously it's that I want to be appreciated for, rather than, you know, my regional dialects, if I've got one anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a big sort of ghettoisation about that. And it's a thing that always rankled with The Fall and with Mark E. Smith, that kind of patronising of the North.
I think Mark E. Sublimated his accent because he was a singer. And like all singers in the rock and roll world, he, we're all trying to sound American, right? It's an American art form, so, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why the Beatles were the most successful of all those groups, because they sounded the most American, I think.
Well, I don't think you've never done that, though, have you? I mean, I know you might.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to be seen.
I'm doing it out here. Any excuse to speak American, and I take it.
I was going to say that when I watched you doing I Want to Be Yours, you've got it off pat, that kind of American kind of, it's great.
Mid-Atlantic, isn't it?
Yeah, because Alex Turner does it as well. I think he's copied it off you, I think.
Who does it? Who?
Alex Turner.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. Yeah, he's an international guy.
Yeah. So,
with an emphasis on stateside.
Yeah. I mean, it's a marriage made in heaven, you and the Arctic Monkeys, isn't it, really? This kind of...
I think so. He's got a beautiful voice. Whatever accent, his tone is beautiful. He's got his.
It is. He's a proper singer.
Oh, he is. He's got his beautiful, relaxed mezzo baritone that can just only get better with age.
And what's good about the Arctic Monkeys, I think, and they don't rest on the laurels, do they?
No, they're always doing something different. What's the point of coming out and recording in the States if you ain't going to come out sounding like with that, that Los Angeles patina of quality? You know, what's the point of going there? You know, why not?
Fantastic. I mean, I have to say, we've done quite a number of episodes of this podcast, and I've never heard the word patina before. That's fantastic.
I had a showroom patina.
And I was going to ask about your book, because I really thought the book I Want to Be Yours was absolutely fantastic. It was kind of I was kind of sorry when it got to the bit about bands in the late 70s, you know, because I've been there and I know that. But the bit about you, when you were a kid, I could have lived in that book there.
Oh, thanks a lot, kid. Because you know, I was a bit like that about it. Because I figured, you know, a lot of autobiographies and memoirs, you know, I always feel like they spend too much time dealing with their childhood. You know, these events are very, you know, they're personal to. I always think, you know, that the bit where you're just getting known, that's the interesting bit. I think, you know, the bit where you're becoming a kind of face.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have to say, I thought the bit about your childhood, it's obviously in the writing, but it just leapt off the page for me. It was like being there.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
No. So, and the other thing that interested me was the kind of the pre-punk kind of thing when you were on the sort of folk circuit.
Well, I was more on the kind of the kind of cabaret I was trying to make it. But I did do a few folk clubs, you know, where they had monologue artists. You know, I used to do the Black Lion Hotel in on the border of Salford and Manchester there on a Friday night. I would do the folk club on a Friday night and the jazz club on the Monday night. You know, just anything where they had a spare few minutes and an empty microphone. You know, that's where I would be, you know, building up my little coterie of fans. You know, and that happened sort of, you know, 4 years before the punk thing. But I was trying to make it in clubs like, you know, I had a residency at Mr. Smith's. In the centre of Manchester there, at Brazil Place, Mr. Smith. And of course...
Yeah, I remember it, yeah.
Yeah, I had a residency there on a Sunday night, you know, and which that was my first sort of serious earner.
Were you the only one then? You the only poet on that circuit?
No other poets on that circuit. No, it was just like, risky comics, all kind of acts you'd get on there... In fact, you know, it was a very interesting milieu for me, if you'll pardon the French, that cabaret thing, because you'd get people that had peaked, you know, real big. They'd been big stars, but they peaked about 10 years ago, but they still had a residual following. I did one show at, I can't remember which club it was. I think it was Jerry Harris's Piccadilly Club. And they had Johnny Ray.
And wow.
He was a guy that I've always been interested in. He was kind of, Elvis was a big fan.
And the Nabob of Sub.
Yeah, the Nabob, you're quite right. The Nabob of Sub, the Prince of Wales.
Morrissey nicked his hearing aid, didn't he?
Yeah. That's, I think that's where Morrissey got it from.
Yeah.
You know, the
I think it was real, was it?
Affectation of the cream Bakelite hearing aid of the mid.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Yeah. So, you ever played with Matt Monroe, the singing bus conductor?
I did do a show with Matt Monroe. That's exactly the kind of act that I would introduce on a Sunday night at Mr. Smith's. Yeah, Matt Monroe, I've dealt with Matt, Sheila Buxton, Shaney Wallace. They were all sort of... There were people that were big in the big band dance, the big dance bands. They always featured a close harmony group, vocal group that featured two guys and a chick. You know, really
fantastic.
On the model of the Meltones and.
All human life was there in those clubs in them days, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, but it was real interesting seeing these people that had known great fame stateside and even been in movies.
Yeah.
And Johnny was a big pal of Judy Garland. They were real buddies. He was a friend of Dorothy.
Yes, the original friend of Dorothy.
Oh, he was, I think that's where they got the term from, Johnny.
So, what about that Batley Variety Club kind of cleaned up on that kind of act, didn't it?
They got Jack Jones there.
Yeah.
They had Jack Jones, all kind of stateside big hitters did the Batley Variety Show.
Yeah, because, I mean, that Wheel Tappers and Shunters was a kind of, that was an amazing program, that, to put that on the TV. Roy Orbison, yeah.
Sorry. My dad saw him. My dad was a regular at the Wheel Tappers and Shunters. He was one of his drinking buddies was a cameraman for Granada. And my dad also, he knew about all the comedians that were on there, you know, Bernard Manning, Colin Crumps, and Frank.
George Roper.
George Roper, yeah. Yeah, but, you know, he came, he would see people like, you know, the Three Degrees. And as I say, the one that impressed the hell out of me was when he came back, he said, that Roy Orbison, he can't half sing. I'm like, I couldn't believe my dad was saying those two words, Roy Orbison, you know. And I'm thinking, why? You know, wow. I mean, that's a big star. That's Elvis's
yeah, favorite. Yeah. That's massive.
Elvis's favorite singer, apart from Elvis.
But they must have made no money at all when they were big then, mustn't they? I mean, if they were still scraping the living around the northern clubs of England.
Oh, yeah.
It's a shit business, as someone once opined.
Well, they were probably grateful to be working at all.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, just they got to see the sight. Anyway, Johnny Ray was always in debt. He was always weighed down with the medical bills or back taxes, which meant that the situation dictated that he was always doing live shows all over the world.
But I think the other thing that did for them, they didn't write anything, did they? So they never got any money from that.
No, they were just getting kind of record residuals and, you know.
Yeah. You would have thought Roy Orbison had made a few, Bob, because he wrote them, didn't he?
Right, yeah, he did write, yeah. Yeah, I just think they, you know, if you're a singer, you like to sing in public, you know.
Maybe.
The instant payoff of a live audience's reaction, you know.
Yeah.
There's no substitute for that. You don't get that in a studio.
No.
And I can see the reason, you know, why they did it. Elvis wanted to do it, you know, but I think it was a good move when the Colonel stopped him from doing that, you know.
You think it was a good move?
Yeah, I do. Why should the king go selling his ass around the world, you know, set up shop in Vegas and the world will make its way to your door? They wasn't Not one of them. He did two shows a day.
Yes.
And every one of them was sold out.
Yeah. Of course. But I mean, it's kind of come back that now, hasn't it? You get Britney Spears and what have you doing them Las Vegas residencies now.
Absolutely. I think Elvis wrote the book on that.
Of course.
Yeah.
Have you seen the film? The Baz Luhrmann?
No. I've got every Elvis movie, every movie Elvis ever made. Why do I have to watch some actor?
You know, it's a good point. It's a very good point.
I'll watch Funny Mac Apolco, Jailhouse Rock, Take Your Choice.
What's your favourite Elvis film then?
Favourite Elvis film? I got two, really. I like Elvis. That's the way it is. You know?
Yeah, fantastic. We stuck into the pictures. I remember in the old days, you could go to the pictures and stay in your seat.
That's right, continuous performance.
Oh, yeah. So we watched that twice, Elvis, that's the way it is.
That's great. That.
Fantastic.
Well, I like Jailhouse Rock, and I loved Loving You, you know, the first Technicolor Elvis movie. That
was yes.
Terrific.
Is that Jailhouse Rock, the one with the woman out of the Monsters in? The woman out of the Addams Family. Is that Jailhouse Rock?
Caroline Jones, she was gorgeous, right? No, that was King Creole.
King Creole, yeah, I think that's my favourite.
He was the girlfriend of Walter Matthau, you know, the gangster that Walter Matthau.
Yes.
You know, Elvis falls in with a bad crowd, Vic Morrow and his pals. And it's based on a Harold Robbins story.
Is it?
A Stone for Danny Fisher.
Wow, a better title.
Elvis was a great movie actor.
He was. I mean, well, he didn't get. I think the films went off a bit by the end, didn't they?
But it wasn't his fault. They're all what?
No, not at all. No,
even though they were schlock. You know what I mean? They weren't because Elvis was in them.
Because Elvis was in them. Yeah, yeah.
You got 14 songs. You got a beautiful location, technical location, millions of fabulous-looking chicks, beautiful cars, great clothes. What's wrong with those films? They're all
beautiful. No. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Describe Elvis's worst film. Fabulous.
the really late one where he's the doctor. What's that one?
The Brothers Alive. He was the only bankable project. Any Warner Brothers film you saw from 1951 It was Elvis that was bankrolling it. He was the only one that you could take to the bank.
Yeah. I always think it's a real shame that he was kind of, because he died in 77, he was kind of frozen in that white flares and the like, Carl Osmond's outfit. Because they were cool then, though, weren't they?
Huh?
They were cool outfits then, but then they got a bit naff looking back at them.
I don't agree. I think he always looked great.
He never got that big either. You get that big thing about how, you know, he was massively overweight. I mean, compared to these days, I don't think he was particularly big, was he?
Not at all. I remember at the time in the Daily Mirror, you know, and Elvis is like 38, 34. Oh, he's getting a little bit heavy around there. You know, he's looking a little bit worse for wear and all of this. You know, it's before anybody was on any health kick. You know,
yeah.
I still think he looked fantastic. Great. That outfit with the cloak. That outfit.
Yeah.
The outfit he wore when he got his FBI badge off President Nixon.
That's a great photo, of that, isn't it? His eyes. Elvis's eyes in that picture.
Yeah, fabulous. With the Napoleon collar and the cape.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I was going to ask you, before we went down the Elvis route, which I could stay down all day if you want, but how did you make the transition then? The sort of kind of punk kind of grew up around you, didn't it? So you were playing clubs and then all of a sudden punk. What made you make the leap to go into these scuzzy clubs with people jumping about and spitting each other?
I already had the clothes because I was trying to make it in the world of young adult entertainment. I, you know, I didn't look like a hippie. I had a kind of Perry Como college boy short haircut, an Ivy League suit, you know, with parallel trousers, you know, and I already looked kind of every at that point. Everybody was looking like a hippie of one kind or another.
Yeah. It's like that thing, you know. They have when you see the Pistols, the audience look like they've come to see Tractor or something, don't they? So
it was Howard Devoto, who was then the singer with Buzzcocks. And he said to me, you know, he said, John, you know, he was a very literate guy, Howard. And he said, Johnny, you know, you shouldn't be working these places. You should be working in these punk rock venues with us. Well, I've been to see them quite recently when they did the Sex Pistols Slaughter and the Dogs gig at the Free Trade Hall. So I kind of got it right away. You know, I get it, garage band, and it was that kind of... It had a vaguely mod look. Well, you know, all them bands on that particular show, which was my introduction, although I'd seen the Ramones earlier.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't really my look, that tough guy leather jacket thing, you know, wasn't really my look. But then I realised that punk had this other, that they purloined the looks of every youth tribe since the Teddy Boys. And then they mixed it up. But there was a right way and a wrong way. There were only two rules, no beards, no flares. And they even broke, look at Peter Hook.
Yeah. Just go in there. It's the guy who looks like the U-boat captain.
He's a rebel, though, man, and he still is. I'll spell it out for you. R-E-B-E-L.
Peter. Wow. So, yeah, I can't imagine you ever wore flares, did you?
I never wore flares. Yes. But I'll tell you who did. Pre-punk, Jesse Hector. Remember him? The Hammersmith Gorillas.
Oh, yes, the Hammersmith Gorillas. I do remember them.
Yeah. We just seen a picture of Jesse with a very recent one with Glenn Matlock.
Oh, yeah.
So he was obviously had a little bit of, well, Hammersmith ain't too far from White City Estate where Cookie and Jonesy hail from. You know, that's their manor, isn't it? West London.
Yes.
Bush, yeah. Smith, White City Estate. So I reckon, Jesse was on their radar.
Right.
They were a no-messing kind of moddy kind of band.
They were. So what about Slaughter and the Dogs then? Were you a fan of them?
Yeah, each of those bands are in that first Pistols gig. Sex Pistols, Slaughter and the Dogs, the Buzzcocks. They all had their unique look. Slaughter and the Dogs were obviously enthralled to David Bowie, Spiders from Mars period. You know, yeah. Wearing silk. Wayne Barrett had a pair of green silk pajamas and matching hair. You have Mick Ross, who idolized and still, I suppose, idolizes the late Mick Ronson.
Yeah.
And I guess I'll be running into Mick later on, actually. He's got a place out here. Last time I ran into Mick, he was with Steve Jones and he came to the show.
In fact, well, he's got a fabulous mid-Atlantic accent, Mick Rossi, hasn't he?
Would have now, yeah.
Brilliant. So you're fitting in okay with the punk then? So which punk band, but obviously The Fall must have connected on a level, or you and Mark, because you're from basically round the corner from each other, aren't you?
Right, we worked together a hell of a lot. Yeah. I was living in Sedgley Park at the time, and that's the part of town that Smithy came from, and I used to see him, you know, just in the neighbourhood. I know him.
You knew his mum, didn't you? Didn't you know, go in his mum's shop?
Yeah, his mum works at the post office where all my layabout friends used to cash their gyros.
So do you think he stood out amongst the punk bands? Well, obviously he did.
Pardon? Sorry?
As a wordsmith, if you'll pardon the pun with Smith, did he stand out for you from the rest of the punk bands?
Absolutely. He was ploughing his own furrow right from the start. But he always rocked the joint.
Yeah.
Always rocked the joint. He never got so artistic that he stopped rocking. You know, and I think that was, you know, he walked a high wire there. You know, he was obviously artistic.
Yes.
But that didn't stop him from being a rocker.
No. I mean, I think if you listen to The Fall in 1977 or you listen to them 2 weeks before he passed away, they still had that one hand on the garage rock kind of thing.
Yeah, there was a thread running through it all the way. Yeah. Fantastic. Great voice.
Say again.
Another thing, he had a great voice when he sang.
Yes.
He had a beautiful, resonant voice.
Well, it was completely unique, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he didn't, he didn't really try and sound like anybody else, which even if you listen to Howard DeVoto when he was with Buzzcocks, you can see he's trying to sound like Johnny Rotten.
Yeah, his phrasing and his, something about it. Yeah, had that kind of punk house style.
House style, yeah. Which The Fall never played, which I think once, failed very quickly, that, didn't it? Because, as you say, those three bands and The Fall and Joy Division sounded absolute, didn't look like each other, didn't sound like each other, but they were all kind of punk or post-punk,
is
a horrible phrase.
Yeah, no, you're quite right. Yeah, but that sort of ba 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 ba, isn't it? That kind of ba 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 ba. That's like a quizzical sort of upswing at the end.
Yes.
Of every line.
Yeah, like Australians.
That was very well spotted. There was a kind of vocal house style for a while.
There was, and you fitted right in.
Yeah, I kind of did, because it was, that's right. Yeah.
Because there's a kind of percussion to the way you used to do poems in them days. Was that by necessity to get people to shut up?
No, it's just I just see it as a kind of one of the components of poetry is meter. But I'm pretty
happy. Yeah, but I mean, there's an attack there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, there is. I know what you mean. Yeah, there is a sharpness about it. It's not languid.
No, you wouldn't say it was languid. No, not at all, no. I saw you support Public Image at Bellevue.
Oh, Bellevue, yeah, me and Linton Kwesi Johnson.
You and Linton Kwesi Johnson, yeah. I mean, there was another poet.
That's where we first met, me, Linton and I, yeah. And soon after that, we went on a UK tour together, double header. We were the only tickets in town when it came to poetry.
Yeah.
Real good tour that was. I enjoyed it immensely.
I mean, the pair of you blew Public Image off the stage that night, I think, because Public Image, they just kind of turned up. They hadn't rehearsed or...
I'm glad you think so.
I definitely do. And I was a big fan, and I'd gone to see Public Image, and it looked like...
But it was very early doors for them, wasn't it?
It was really. And he'd lost the drummer by the sound of it, about 10 minutes before the gig, I think.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, the style like that, you used to do them really fast in them days.
I've slowed down a little bit now. Not because I'm too old to do them fast, but, you know, things change, styles change. The stuff I write now ain't really very similar to what I did then, other than the fact that it rhymes and has a meter, you know what I mean? It is a bit leisurely. It's a bit more... I said it before, it wasn't languid. I think it does have a certain language quality now, sometimes.
Well, you've earned it, haven't you?
Yeah.
Definitely have. So, you did a lot of gigs with The Fall.
Loads, yeah. I went on tours with them, and sure did.
Did you know him well, Mark, on a personal level, or was it only kind of when you worked together?
No, I knew him real well, yeah. He used to go in the same pub, The George.
The George, blimey.
So, we knew each other socially.
Long now.
Yeah.
There's a great story you tell in your book, and, well, I say great, I'm 20 years of therapy, I'm trying to get over it now, but where you were in Australia and the tour guy says, I tried to take Marky Smith in here last week and The Fall, and he said, don't invite the rest of them.
Well, so we took him on one side, yeah, with a guy called Dennis Stoneman ran this
club
of a trade union club, which is not as political as it sounds. It was a rock and roll venue in Surrey Hills in Sydney. And he was looking at, he was taking care of the whole, so he said, all right, your mate's here the other week. I was going to take him to the Brown Derby. They've got one in Sydney as well.
Yeah.
And he took him on one side and he just said, just me and you are going, mate. Get him a bag of chips.
Well, I'm here to tell you, that was me, and he didn't get us a bag of chips.
And he won't appreciate it, mate.
No, we didn't even get the bag of chips. Nothing. I was going to say he did that to us twice, but I'm pretty sure he did it to us a number of times, but I know about it twice.
He kind of has to fuck things up. He had to fuck things up, didn't he?
Yeah. I think that was part of the sustainability of it.
I think it is, don't get too, complacent about anything.
Don't get too complacent and expect to be fed every night.
Yeah, that's it. You know better than I. You've been on the motherfucker's payroll.
Well, there's a great quote from you. I was looking, it was when the Q had a special sort of edition. It was, he might have been a cunt, but he was never a wanker.
And that's where you can quote me on that.
That's a fantastic quote.
But he was never a wanker.
Because it's a permanent state, isn't it, wanker?
Yeah, wankerdom. You just can't shake that quality off.
Fantastic. So how does it feel to be given this freedom of Salford then? How was that?
Oh, that was fantastic. I couldn't believe the people that came to shake my hand. Rabbi Saunders.
Wow.
From Cheatham Hill. Very, a good counsellor. Yeah. And some great people. It was a fabulous day out. Fabulous day.
What do you get for that? Can you walk your sheep across the bridge?
I walk my flock of sheep across Victoria Bridge from Salford into Manchester. I check that out. No. Other than that, I don't know what it entitles me to.
I trust you've made plans to do it.
I've been asking them, what am I entitled to do here? All I get is this sheep thing.
Well, I haven't even got any sheep. What's the point of that?
Oh, sheep.
So is it true that you gave the Blue Orchids a name? Is that your childhood gang? Is that right?
Yeah, it was. It was a gang I was in called. Pussy Gang. Pussy Name. Everybody in that gang. Everybody was in a gang,
If
you went in the wrong street, you were asking for a pasting, And
it's not a name to strike fear into the hearts, is it? The Blue Orc, because it's hardly the Peaky Blinders.
I didn't even know what an orchid was, but I'd seen this movie starring Edward G. Robinson, and it was called Brother Orchid, and it's when he's on the run from a rival gang. And he checks into this monastery, hides out in a monastery, specialized in growing flowers. Horticulture was their thing. So they were all named after a flower, you know, Brother Rose, Brother Iris, Brother Violet, and things like this, you know.
Is this a real film, or did you dream this? This is
called Brother Orchid. So it's a. And so I figured, you know, that's a kind of gangster flower. You know, it's got that,
right.
You know, that guy, hey, that's got class, Brother Orchid,
yeah.
You know. So I figured it had that sort of quality about it that could work in our favour. But there was something, like, wrong with the health of every member of that gang. Yeah. One guy had impetigo, remember that? We had purple blocks all over his face. Another guy was an epileptic. I just got out of convalescence from tuberculosis. But the worst off was Billy, who was the tallest of the gang. But he was a haemophiliac. So, you know,
he was great in a fight, wasn't he?
We used to walk around avoiding trouble.
The perfect gang.
It was a full-time job, avoiding trouble. I abroad.
So you suggested that to Martin for the name of his band?
Well, I think I was talking about it in the George about what I'm telling you now about the Blue Orchid gang.
It's a great name. It's a much better name for a band than it is for a street gang.
It's a great name for a band. And they were a good band.
Do you get? Great. I mean, all the best band names don't really mean anything, do they? I think if you've got a band name that means something, you're kind of tied down a bit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which is why I always think The Falls are a fantastic name.
Great name. It's timeless.
Yeah.
Timeless, and it's got loads of meanings. You know, it could be Autumn, American Autumn.
Yeah.
It would be the Albert Camus book.
Yeah.
La Chute.
Or the fall of, you know, Lucifer.
Civilization as we know it, or, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire, you know.
Yeah.
The evocative name, isn't it? The fall.
Yeah.
Invite.
I mean, he's got a few of them phrases, hasn't he? He's like Totally Wired and Rebellious Jukebox.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, what a great.
Has he just become. They could become like famous in their own right. That, I mean, Totally Wired's everywhere.
Enter the general vocabulary effortlessly.
Yeah. I mean, you've done a bit of that yourself, haven't you?
I hope so. Yeah.
No, definitely. I mean, you're on the syllabus. You can't get any better than that.
The fact that that my poetry is being rammed down the reluctant throats of school children on a daily basis. You can't get better than that.
You can't get better than that, no.
Like, finally, I'm in a position to make people miserable. And this.
but yeah, you say that goes back to that golf thing, isn't it? They might think they're miserable, but they'll thank you for it later.
I think that's the way poetry works. It sneaks up on you 30 years later, you might think. So that's what J.K. That's what Houseman meant when he said that. That's what shit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Whatever. It creeps up on you. You're not going to get it right away, especially if you're a school kid, you know. You know, you're not going to understand a poem written by a 35-year-old 100 years ago. Why waste your time at it, you know? But I think they come at it from the wrong angle now sometimes, from what I can gather, you know. They dwell on what this poet meant by this line, you know. But I don't think that's the way you appreciate poetry. You absorb it like the lyrics of a song if it's done right.
If it's done right, yeah.
Not the Great American Songbook. That was a big influence with me when I first started writing poetry, because I didn't understand those lyrics of the Great American Songbook. But you know, Sinatra was the soundtrack to my life pre-Elvis, And, you know, there'd be all these songs about divorce and an unrequited love affair, you know, adult themes, you know what I mean? They were pitching records, not at teenagers, you know, they were pitching it at people had just been demobbed from the army that had been separated from their families and their wives or girls.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was aimed at the young adult world.
So they're kind of deeper in a way, aren't they?
They are. That's why you grow into those songs. Same as country music, you know, you grow into it as you grow. You know.
I mean, I think it's a real mark of whether you appreciate music if you get country music, because a lot of people just dismiss it as maudlin rubbish, but...
It's the true story of people's lives.
Yes, yeah.
Especially...
Mark was obviously a big country fan.
He covered George Jones, all of those people, didn't he? You know, White Light.
Yeah, yeah.
That one, didn't he? In fact, there's an album around of... there's an album, isn't there, of Smithy's covers.
Yes, there is, yeah.
A great deal of variety in there, isn't there? You know,
there is.
You've got the Nuggets garage bands on the one hand, and you've got the George Jones and the Gene Vincents and the, you know what I mean? And the Dudley. Yeah. 6 days on the road. Did he do that one, Dave Dudley? Yeah.
But there's a kind of the thing about, I mean, it's like people dismiss country music, like I say, but there's a lot of shit country music. There's a lot of shit, every kind of music, isn't there, really, I suppose?
Shit stuff, you know, everybody's a virtuoso musician on it, aren't they? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Even the bad stuff.
Even the bad stuff's good.
Something good. Yeah. Yeah, but I love country music. I've come to it. You know, I play it a lot.
Do you? Yeah. Is that what you'd listen to?
I wouldn't say I listen to it more than any other. I tell you, I play every day. Elvis and Dean Martin and Chet Baker. At home. It's kind of, you know, when I'm cooking.
Yes.
I like that kind of thing. Louis Prima.
So what's your favourite Dean Martin then? What kind of Dean Martin floats your boat?
I like Return to Me and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Bolari. The stuff where it gives you a little bit of little bits of Napoli in there, you know.
The Italian stuff's great, isn't it?
Yeah. I love that stuff. I love his voice. I think Elvis was a big Dino fan. If you listen to it, you know that thing where he goes, you know, you know what I mean? What did he say there? You know, the slurry bits.
Yes. Yeah. I always wonder about that, D-Man, how much of that's an act, you know, that acting drunk all the time. It was, because he never gets any more drunk than just the right amount.
No, that's right. I've got cassettes of Dean live at the Sands. And he doesn't complete one song. He don't complete just gags. And you can hear the no-necks ringside all say, "You're gonna have a song, Dean." You know what I mean? And his reply was, "You want to hear the song? Buy the record."
Yeah. Well, that's it. That's exactly right, isn't it?
Now he was Mr. Entertainment, a gifted comedian. When he was working with Jerry Lewis, he wasn't a straight man.
No, not at all, no.
Contributed to the humour of the piece.
You'd never have said, though, when they split up, that he'd have been the bigger success.
You wouldn't have said that, no. You'd have think,
no.
Because Jerry, they never fell out, you know. You know, they
would. Well, I think it's like all of these double acts, you want them to be like this bromance where they absolutely love each other and live in each other's pockets. But a lot of the time, they're just kind of colleagues, aren't they?
Yeah, colleagues. But Jerry was on there, you know, I love that guy. I love that guy. You know, and same with Dean, you know, they never said a bad thing about each other.
Really? Oh, right, okay.
Loved each other.
He's a fantastic actor, Jerry Lewis.
Oh, fantastic.
King of Comedy has got to be one of my favourite films ever, I think. And he is so good in that, The King of Comedy.
He's great in that. great in that. I love his movies.
He's brilliant.
I love them.
Yeah.
I loved those movies as a kid. Hollywood or Bust.
Yes.
Jumping Jacks. You know, I loved all them films. Who's Minding the...
The Nutty Professor is a cracker.
Pardon?
Oh, the Nutty Professor.
Nutty Professors. That's just fantastic. That's genius.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a terrible remake.
Who did the suit? Who made those suits, man? Buddy.
Yeah, that suit, yeah. When he first becomes Buddy Love, that suit's amazing.
Amazing, man. When he does that one thing, that old black magic with one
yes.
thing on the piano. Genius.
Fantastic. Well, I think our time's going to be up fairly soon, John, and I don't want to keep it because I know you're a very, very busy man.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
It's been an absolute joy to speak to you. I mean, this podcast is ostensibly about the fall, but I like it to go wherever it's going.
Yes,
well, me and Steve do.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's a when we talk about the fall, it's a neighbourhood topic.
Yes. The guy's doing doo-wop on the corner.
Yeah, yeah, that's like that. Dion and the Belmonts.
Fantastic. Hey, I tell you, there's a talent.
There's a
Dion DiMucci.
I love that guy. I love
Yeah. him. It's later, some of his later albums are just amazing. There's one that my son's in his 20s, and he played me this album, and I said, who's that? That's fantastic. And he said, it's Dion.
Was it in his period? He walked down many avenues. He had such a versatile voice. He did that.
Fantastic.
Was it that The Road I'm On?
Yes.
Is that the one?
I think it is. I mean, I think he's a big influence on the Arctic Monkeys. I think he reminds me of Alec Turner.
Wow. Well, that's an accolade indeed. That's an
indeed.
Accolade indeed. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love that guy. I love Dion.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. Well, yeah, we haven't even done Frankie Valli yet, if we're going to talk about fantastic Italian-American singer.
You know that one he did, A Sunday Kind of Love?
I don't know that one.
Kind of love. A love to last more than Saturday night. It's a real romantic ballad.
You need to sing more, John. You need to make more records. You did one with Hugh Cornwell, didn't you?
Oh, I did. That was such a great opportunity. I'm so grateful to H for getting me involved in that. I've always fancied myself as being able to carry a tune.
You can carry a tune. You should do more.
Thank you. I'd love to do it more. I'd love to do it more.
But there's a question. Can you write song lyrics?
I can't do it. If I could have done that, I would have done it right from the start. Like I say, it's far more commercial proposition than writing poetry.
Yeah, but how ridiculous would that be if you did a song and you had to get somebody else to write the words? That would just be bonkers.
Yeah, I guess it would, but I don't know. It calls for different skills, I think, writing songs.
It is a different skill, yeah. I mean, we touched on that earlier, and I think there's a lot of talk to where they try and make poems into songs and songs into poems.
Only Alex Turner can do this. I can only think of it.
Yeah, he had to leave a lot out, though, didn't he, of I Want to Be Yours to make it into a song?
Yeah, I'll give you two examples where a poem was turned successfully into a song. Alex's version of I Want to Be Yours and Sinatra's version of The Road to Mandalay.
Really?
Take me some.
I'll have to listen. I've never heard that. I'll listen out to that.
Well, listen to it. Rudyard Kipling, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, does he sing it or does he just like do... He's not like a William Shatner thing where he talks over the...
William Shatner. It's not Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
That is one of the...
That's one of the...
What is a song for the ages, that is?
No, he does it. It goes like, take me somewhere east of Suez where the best is like the worst, where there ain't no Ten Commandments and a cat can raise a thirst. Pavilion, for it's there that I would be. Ba 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 da ba ba ba, coming stately through the sea on the road to Mandalay. Don't you hear them tugboats chugging out of China to Bombay? On the road to Mandalay, you know that one.
I do. Yeah. I never put it together with the Rudyard Kipling. Right, okay.
That's the only two times where I can say a poem was converted into a song.
Is Mack the Knife, was that always a song? Or was that, did that start off as a poem?
It was always a song. It was part of the Threatening Opera written by...
Oh, yes. Well, yeah.
So, and it was originally it was sung by Lottie Lanier.
Oh, right, okay.
The woman who played Rosa Klebb in From Russia With Love, actually.
Wow. Great footwear.
Yeah, you know, with the footwear. Yeah, with the leaf footwear, yeah.
And she sang that?
She sang the original of that in the Threatening Opera by the way. So.
Right, okay. I didn't realise. I just think of Bobby Darin and I thought I know it was in the opera, but...
He suits it up into a kind of Sinatra-esque club number, you know, but it has that artistic kind of origin, you know, part of a larger work, which was a very...
Indeed.
It was European, but very Americanized. I'll tell you another one she sang, Lottie Lanier sang, and she gets a mention in the song, doesn't she?
Does she?
It's Audrey, Lottie Lanier, good old Lucy Brown.
All right.
Forms. On the right, now that Mackie's back in
town. Yeah. Wow.
The name check in it. But she also did that, the Alabama song, you know, the one that Jim Morrison featured in.
Whiskey Bar, yeah.
The Whiskey Bar number, yeah, she did.
She did that, right? Good Boy did that as well, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right, but it was originally, again, Lottie Lanier.
Well, I knew you were going to educate me. I didn't realise it was going to be on the...
It's the first time I've been...
The Songs of Lottie Lanier.
Anybody, but thanks. I can live with that.
Right, well, I'm going to let you go, John. Or Dr. John, I should say.
Yep.
How was that, getting a doctorate?
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Finally, I can open that cosmetic surgery clinic that I've been to.
They let you do that, do they? Once you've got any kind of doctor at all.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
I'm new.
Okay, John.
Pleasure, kid.
Absolutely pleasure. Thanks so much. An absolute honour to speak to you.
Let's do it again. Be lucky for the...
Let's do it, yeah.
Be lucky.
We'll do it again when Steve's back.
Huh?
We'll do it again when Stevie's back in town.
That'd be nice.
Thanks for joining us for this week's Old Brother. Episodes are released every 2 weeks, so keep an eye out for episode 4 coming soon. You can find us on Spotify and Apple and all the usual suspects, but we're hosted at shows.acast.com/old-brother. Huge thanks to the good doctor. I can't recommend enough that you catch him on his upcoming tour. Gigs include the London Palladium and 2 nights at Salford's Lowry. Details are available at johncooperclark.com. By the way, I wouldn't hang about as they're all close to selling out. As for us, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Old Brother Show to keep up with all the latest news. And don't forget to like or give us a rating on your favourite platform. You can even tell your friends about us if you like. And remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-da!
Vous aussi, vous avez de grandes ambitions? Vous aussi, vous cherchez à vivre vos rêves et être une meilleure version de vous-même au quotidien? Nous avons déjà un point commun. Ne pensez-vous pas que s'il y a bien des gens qui mettent tout en place pour réussir et s'accomplir, ce sont bien nos championnes et nos champions? Et oui, ils sont accompagnés et coachés tous les jours pour atteindre leur but, être heureux, exceller et réussir leur carrière. Et si nous aussi, nous avions accès à leurs conseils? Croyez-moi, on pourrait tous s'en inspirer. C'est pour cette raison que j'ai créé le podcast Extraterrien. Il fait partie de la sélection Acast Recommande et vous pouvez le retrouver sur toutes les applications de podcast, dont Acast ou votre appli de podcast préféré. Allez, retrouvez-moi, Extraterrien. Ciao.